Today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to local MP Bim Afolami to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get your answers from Bim this time, he'll be back again next month. And also, you can message at any time jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com and get those questions in. But Bim, since we last talked, you've displayed one of your many skills. You have turned to being
gifts.
A teacher.
You prefer gifts.
I apologise that I've wrongly labelled that. You've shown your many gifts and turned your hand to being a teacher and have had to homeschool. What was this experience like for you, Bim?
Grim. No, it was fine. I'm very lucky compared to lots of people. So it was all right. And my wife runs a business which she's running from home. We also have somebody, our nanny, who lives with us as well. So it was like a sort of team of teachers, of which I was definitely the most inept. And that it's the thing, I suppose, what can I say that's interesting about it? The interesting thing about it is that you realize the extent to which school is part childcare. Now, nobody likes to describe school in this way. And of course it is, I said part childcare. It is not the reason why you send your kids to school, but you just underestimate every day how much your kid is doing when you are not there and that you don't see at all. And now you're seeing much more of it. So on some level, that was quite interesting. But then, you know, we've only had to do it for a little bit because our kids are key workers. So they have been going in more broadly. So I am in awe at what parents all over the country, indeed in this area, have been doing. So I'm not complaining at all.
With your experience there, did you focus on a specific topic? Were you politics teacher? Were you history teacher? Were you kind of like carpe diem in terms of a Dead Poet Society? What was your approach to teaching your children?
Really, they're very small, you know, so one's reception, one's year two. It is comparatively easy. The difficulty I found was uploading all these worksheets and then sending them in at the end of the day and doing all of that printing and making sure the system worked, and all of that admin was just much more. And of course, this is what teachers tell us about all the time. The admin is the nightmare. It's not the teaching, it's everything outside the classroom. And actually, I think that is something that I better appreciate, is just getting kids ready to do that learning takes much more time than you might have appreciated. So there we are.
So moving on from your experience in your own house to across the country, you've been part of the Conservative government that has had a highly successful vaccination rollout. And actually, bringing it to your local area, your area has been highlighted by Health Minister Matt Hancock as being one of the highest performing, Harpenden Health PCN. Why has there been such a success in your area, Bim?
There are two main reasons for the success in Harpenden, and the health secretary mentioned, and I won't list them now because, you know, people can read the letter, but it's mentioned a lot of the key people who have been so pivotal to that success, showing how far that success had spread far and wide. The fact the health secretary knew who all these, or rather the health secretary had been told who all these people were. There are two main reasons for the success. The first reason is the people. The people in Harpenden and the surrounding area are very law-abiding. They are they have good relationships with their local GPs. And when they were told that there was this vaccination available, they went. Our rates were sky high. I mean, there was barely anybody. And I've been volunteering on Fridays over the last couple of months, so I've seen this firsthand myself at the vaccination center in Harpenden. There were really barely anybody turning down the vaccine. They really are sky high. That's one reason. The second reason is the Harpenden Trust and the volunteer network. Because the truth is, large parts of this country, I don't know if it's most or not, but large parts of this country, if you tried to get 800 people to volunteer within 48 hours, to give up their own time to, over a long period of time now, we're in month three now, to help people being vaccinated, it would be a bit hard going, bearing in mind the population is only about 30-odd thousand. And yet, we had over 800 people get in touch saying they're willing to help within 48 hours. When you've got a volunteer network like that, working with the local NHS, that equals success. And so it's really a combination of the people and the volunteer network, which, by the way, I suppose is the people as well. It's that that is the reason for the success.
We do have to ask, have you or your family members had the protection yet from getting one?
My parents have, because my father's a doctor, my mum's a pharmacist, so they've had it. They've had the jab. In fact, they've had COVID as well a few months ago. So that's it. I have not had it yet, but I will soon, I am sure.
And just continuing with this discussion, because I think one of the key things as our role here as a media outlet is to kind of combat any of this fake news and conspiracies around getting a vaccination. So were they completely fine, you know, slight side effects, but apart from that, they're fit and healthy once again?
They're completely fine. I mean, the problem, when people talk about the fake news and stuff, and it's completely true, and I've been told that, you know, if you have the vaccine, Bill Gates is going to follow me around with a chip that's being implanted into me. What I say to people, by the way, when people talk about all these conspiracy theories, is I say, have you not actually seen, you know, how politics works, how government works? Does it look like there's a big grand master plan of like a big sort of scary person stroking a cat, you know, in a Bond chair? I mean, just that is not how the world is, you know. But I think it satisfies a sort of human need for order and control, which religion used to serve the purpose of. Now fewer people are religious, they often use conspiracy theories. And Britain is not the only place for that. Frankly, we're a lot less prone to that than lots of other places. But the interesting thing about it is, even when you could think of the most ridiculous thing you could think of, like, I don't know, aliens run the country, or really bizarre things, in any opinion poll, you will find 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8% of people who agree with it. And so actually, the fact that our take up of the vaccine so far is about 95% is insanely high. Go and look at what's going on in Europe. I mean, they can barely get anyone to take these things. So, and look, I happen to think that's the fault of certain European politicians, but that's, again, a separate issue. The truth is, we are less susceptible to this than most countries, because we're broadly sensible and we understand the importance of getting this vaccine so we can get back to normal.
And talking there about normal, about the future, and this month you explained that the government has already taken some big steps forward on climate change, but now we have to go even further to get on track to our world leading target of achieving net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. I did want to ask here, Bim, will there be a focus on the aviation sector? As often individuals talk about not importing foods or certain goods, but why should foreign producers and domestic consumers pay more or miss out when we should focus on changing the transport system to make importing those goods eco-friendly?
Well, the problem is, it's not the importing of the goods that's actually the biggest problem. That's the truth. The biggest problem is the production of goods. And as long as we are producing whatever it is, any sort of good, in a carbon intensive way, in a country that has no or very low standards in that regard, then you're not really going to get anywhere. Having a go at the freight airline that takes it from, I don't know, a country in Asia or Africa to Europe isn't really the ball game. The ball game is making sure you produce stuff as cleanly as possible. And so how do you do that? Well, it's sort of very complicated, and it's COP26 later this year. The government's doing some work on this and hopefully to bring some countries together. But in its most fundamental sense, we need to make it financially viable to produce things. And when I say things, I mean manufactured things as much as agricultural things, i.e. food, in as environmentally sustainable a way as possible. That is the core thing. It needs to be financially viable. So how do we make it financially viable? It's all the technological innovation we do in countries like Britain, and then making sure that we can link up internationally with countries all over the world to say to them, look, you don't have to burn. And I make a basic habit. You don't have to make that car tire using kerosene. You can generate the heat you need in order to make a tire using a cleaner fuel in a different way because of this technology that we have developed in Britain. And by the way, we're going to sell it to you affordably. That's really what you need to do. Because until you can do that, then you're not really fixing a lot of the problems. So for me, it's about producing things in as clean a way as possible.
So is the focus going forward going to be on mutual cooperation, but also focusing on country by country comparative advantage?
Well, comparative advantage in this sense is quite unhelpful, because the moment that countries try and play each other off by trying to increase the costs, in effect, of producing a good somewhere else compared to their own country, then you're in a dangerous spot. What you therefore need is to act in quite a global way. You can't have, it's a bit like how you act on fraud, right? Broadly speaking, I can't now take loads of money from your bank account and run to another country and expect that police can't get me. If I go to another country, there are very few places in the world I can go where I can't be picked up by the Interpol or the police in that country. Very, very few, because it's recognized, that is a universally recognized fraud, or it's theft, I suppose. But, you know, it's a universally recognized offense. You can't hide from the law. And in effect, what we need is a global view on how we produce stuff the more in the carbon intensive way and to reduce that carbon intensity. Because until you do that, then on some level, a lot of the other stuff you do doesn't really matter very much. And the biggest thing is manufacturing processes. And obviously there are all sorts of things that happen domestically, and I won't bang on about them, I've talked about them before, but it's everything to do with buildings and domestic transport and energy production. But on some level, we sort of know what the right things are to do in those areas. We just need to do it. We know what we need to do. We know that we need to have more electric cars, you know, and phase out petrol and diesel cars. We know we need to insulate our buildings. We know we need more renewable energy. You know, we know all this. The difficulty is manufacturing processes where at the moment we do not know how to produce, I don't know, cement without doing it in an incredibly carbon intensive way. So how can we get the carbon intensity of producing something like cement or indeed something like cement that does the same job? How do we do that? That is where we need the innovation.
You're bringing innovation locally, though. You've expressed you're bringing eco-friendly initiatives to your office. So, Bim, could you tell us how you are going to have carbon offsetting working with the Woodland Trust in your own office in Harpenden?
Yes, so this is really exciting. Well, at least it's exciting for me, which is one of the difficulties is when you talk about the environment, things you want to do, quite reasonably, some clever person at some point says, wait, hold on, what are you doing in your work or in your life? And apart from sort of mumbling about an electric car, you haven't really got much to say. So I thought, what could I do that would be a leadership thing, it would have a difference, and that I could definitely show that I was doing something and that would actually do something of value, wouldn't just be a sort of PR stuff. And so what working with Laura Bailey, who runs my office, I said, well, what we should do is offset each year the emissions from my office, and we can calculate that through various means, and plant trees in the constituency, not plant them anywhere, plant trees in the constituency to offset that. Now, the reason why I'm working with the Woodland Trust is because the Woodland Trust, because of their expertise and knowledge, know what sort of trees should be planted in what areas at what time of the year, Because you don't just want to randomly go down, buy some trees and stick them down somewhere, because actually that's not sustainable. So working with the Woodland Trust, I am confident that we're planting trees in the right sort of places, in the right way, at the right times of year. And critically then, of course, working with local communities about where, you know, last weekend I was in the village of Ickleford, which is just north of Hitchin, planting trees there. I was planting cedar trees, as it so happens, in Ickleford. Now, every single community that I've been in touch with in my constituency, various different parish councils, various landowners, we're now planting trees with them. Now that's a really, really cool, interesting thing. And will have a big benefit over time, not just in climate terms, but to the amenity of the villages and in which we all live. And I just think that's a really exciting, interesting thing to do.
You talked there about what you are doing, something of value that you're going to change the area. Now, last month we talked about the fact that you might be taking on the Mine Challenge, which is a challenge to run around Hertfordshire in a sense, you know, you're not actually going to do the full length at one time, but it's planned routes so that you cover that area in a certain mileage in a certain amount of time. You said that you'd be happy to discuss with us this month about your progress. I do have to ask, have you been able to put some time aside, because we know you've been very busy, to be able to do a little bit towards this Mine Challenge?
I know. I have very good excuse for it, which was that I was forced to be in isolation for 2 weeks. It was a bit of a bore, but I am confident that on Saturday I will be able to start. Because I will be going on a run on Saturday with one of my friends who's a lot older than me, but he's one of those irritatingly fit people. Like the people who look like they could do the Tour de France. He's one of those people. You know, we all hate them, but we also envy them as well. And I'm going on a run with him.
So
I will try. I think we're going to go about 5 miles. That's the plan. Because I didn't think I could manage anymore. My constituency, we don't want a by-election, so I think it's important I stay alive. So I think it's going to be about 5 miles.
You're building up towards a larger route there. It's a sensible thing to undertake, and like you said there, I don't think your constituents, but also your family, would probably miss you a little bit there as well, Pim, if something were to happen.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence, but yeah.
So let's move on to something else that you've done this month, and you corresponded with a constituent informing about the lack of accessible online content for her deaf child. Will you campaign for Parliament itself to also be more accessible?
This is a really, really, really good point. The short answer is yes. There are some things that have happened. So the budget, which the Chancellor gave on Wednesday, this week's Wednesday, the 3rd of March, the budget for the first time was signed at the same time. So we are making progress. I'm not, by the way, saying that is some sort of huge revelation. It should have happened years ago, but I think the recognition is there that we need to do a lot more. The really, really, really tough thing, I'm afraid, is we actually need more people with disabilities in Parliament. When I was younger at school, one person I had come and speak when I was in charge of our political society was David Blunkett, who was then Home Secretary. And he's a very impressive guy, but you know, I was so blown away by how he dealt with the fact that he was blind and was one of the most senior politicians in the country. And what an example to so many people, myself included, about the huge capacity of people who might have a disability in one area. You know, and what an example he is and was. And so I think it's not just, you know, sign language here or, you know, making it easier for wheelchairs there or all of those things, though important they are, is it's actually becoming a member of parliament or a minister or whatever more accessible. Because if we can do that, then I think the power of the lived example is so great. And I use David Blunkett as a very good example, because I've never, ever, ever forgotten meeting him and how he dealt with everything. And I remember just thinking, gosh, you know, he has achieved so much and he's got this disability, and yet he's incredibly able and successful as well.
Would you take on the ideas of somebody like Dr. Jessica Smith from Southampton? She wrote a fantastic report this month that was published called The Remotely Representative House, which actually your fellow colleague Karen Bradley was there, and there was a cross kind of party from actually Lib Dem Daisy Cooper as well, just talking about 21 points to make the House more representative. Are these kind of ideas that you would embrace from people that have done the research to look into making Parliament available for individuals, as you've described there?
I haven't read them, but you know, they're all, you know, it seems very sensible, so I will take a look at that. But yes, I think we do need to do that, in particular as we look to come to renovate Parliament in the coming years, which is a sort of looming thing. As we look to that, we're going to have to make sure we do it in a sensitive way.
So focusing the attention once again on your constituency, and the safety of Redbourne Road has been a concern for a very long while now. But this month you've been working to try and improve things. Could you describe what processes you've been working through to try and improve safety on what has been quite a dangerous road?
Yeah, so people may not know this, and I know that before I became an MP, you know, I didn't fully appreciate this. Roads like Redbourne Road, which is the A5183, are the responsibility of the county council. And they're not the district council, not St Albans District Council, but Hertfordshire County Council. And the short answer is working with some local campaigners and myself and local councillor Annie Brewster in particular, trying to get the county council to go through the steps required to first of all ascertain how dangerous it is. We know it's dangerous, but actually trying to quantify that and then understand what it is we can do about that. And we have got some way, so we've already, you know, the council has committed to doing various things. And effectively it is in the process of being analysed, if that's the right way of putting it, for all of those things. But, you know, we have not done anything yet. And so the difficulty with so much of this is you've really got to not allow it to fall into the long grass, to get stuck in the long grass. So the county council, we've had, I think, probably it's 3 meetings already in the last couple of months. The county council know they have to act. They know I'm behind it. They know the county local county councillor is behind it. There are always discussions around money, but actually at the moment what we are is simply trying to make sure we have a sense of what needs to be done. And it's my view that once you know that, we can always figure out the money afterwards. But until you can actually say, this is what we know needs to happen, you know, you haven't really got anywhere. So that's what we're working on at the moment.
Talking about the future, and one of the biggest budgets in living memory, probably one of the biggest budgets in British history, was announced this week. The 2021 budget was fleshed out by Rishi Sunak, and I'm sure, you know, you've discussed before, Bim, that you've been involved previously with financial discussions in Parliament. So could you talk us through some of the highlights, especially ones that you think will really impact positively your local constituency to recover post-COVID?
What do I want to highlight? There's a bunch of stuff around investment. So anybody who owns a business, let me start from the beginning. It's continuing the COVID support until the pandemic's over. That's the first thing, and that's very important. Secondly, it's there are a lot of initiatives and incentives for businesses to invest more. And in particular, there's something which rather clunkily we've called the super deduction, which in effect means if a business invests £10 in machinery, in a new computer system, in new lorry to take kit from one end of the country to the other, whatever. It's investing something for the business. That business will be able to deduct against its tax 130% of that amount. So it would mean you'd be able to, and if that business who's invested that £10 made a profit of £13 that year, it would be able to deduct £13 against its taxable amount, which therefore means that business would pay no tax. Now, that is a big incentive for businesses to invest. Now, why does investment matter? Investment matters because it creates longer term growth of a business. And what does that mean in simple terms? If you own a pub, if all the chairs are tatty, the bar stools are rubbish, the glasses are old and rank, people aren't going to want to come to your pub. If you invest in new bar stools, new chairs, a nice rug, a nice, I don't know, wood burner in the corner of the pub, and it's warm and cozy and people like it, you're actually likely to improve the profitability of that pub, which means that you'll be able to employ one more person because your pub's making more money. That means for that local area has created a job, right? So that's how investment, in simple terms, increases growth. The other thing I'd highlight from the budget, and I wrote a piece in the Times today on this thing, was it's something called Help to Grow. The chief economist of the Bank of England, a guy called Andy Haldane, who is literally one of the cleverest guys in the country, he's done a lot of analysis around why Britain isn't out per head as productive as a lot of our competitors. And one of the reasons is that the difference between how productive our top performing companies and bottom performing companies are is about 80% greater than it is for our competitors. Now, this matters because, in effect, unless you are more productive, you will not be as prosperous. You know, prosperity equals more cash more money you're making per head, right? Put it simply. So how do we make ourselves more productive? There are all sorts of things. You've got skills, you've got infrastructure, you've got education. I mean, it's a full range of things, very complicated range of things. But one of them is that with small businesses, which are the vast majority of companies are small, with small businesses giving people assistance to be better managers, to run their companies a bit more effectively, you know, to make 5% more a year because you understand a bit better how to manage. Because actually, people who do MBAs tend to work for very big companies or very big banks. You don't tend to get many people who've got that sort of level of training running small businesses, right? Because they don't have the time or money. So what we're offering is a scheme whereby local business schools will effectively make it very, very cheap, in many senses free, for local SME business owners to go and get management training. I think that's hugely beneficial. In addition, it will also give them discounted software, discounted technology adoption, abilities to adopt new technology. So what all of these things will do is hopefully just increase the profitability of small businesses. And any of you who run a small business will know, if you're making a 10% margin and that 10% margin becomes a 15% margin, that is transformative. That really matters. And if we can do that across hundreds of thousands, indeed millions of small businesses across the country, through investment in skills and technology, I think that's really beneficial. I know it will benefit a lot of people in my constituency.
The budget hasn't been without criticism, though. Local Hertfordshire MP Daisy Cooper, who I also interview each month, has been more critical on the viewpoint of the budget, stating that there was nothing to tackle climate emergency, nothing on education, nothing for young people, nothing to fix the NHS, and it goes on, nothing to fix the broken business rates, nothing for exporters hit badly by Brexit. So my question to you, Bim, is what is the government doing for what is seemingly overlooked groups, especially one you talk about SMEs there, but one that she's highlighted is nothing for the 3 million excluded entrepreneurs. Will there be something else coming up in government policy to help out what is looking like overlooked groups?
The truth is this, right? There is no budget where everybody's happy. That's just life. And you can't make everybody happy. there is a point around that people say, oh, there's, you know, there wasn't, you know, so she said, well, nothing for young people or nothing for NHS or whatever it is. This budget very much had an economic focus. The spending plans around NHS and education, all those things, were set last year, earlier on in the year. It wasn't as if we've changed those. We haven't brought them down. We've just left them where they were. And in addition, what we try to do is make sure we get the economy moving again. And on jobs, you know, a huge part of the budget is about plan for jobs. It's about getting people into work, supporting that. So that, I think, will benefit young people in particular. But look, you know, opposition MPs, it's very difficult, Daisy, because, you know, you've only got 10 Lib Dems or 11 or whatever. It's very, very difficult to get heard. So as a result, it tends to drive what I might describe as sort of slightly trying, one has to be a bit more hysterical to make noise because it's very, very difficult to get your voice out there. And I appreciate that. I'm not criticizing her unduly for that. But I just think that it's a bit exaggerated. And overall, this budget is a very good, sensible, broad-based budget. But of course, you can't please everyone.
One group of individuals that have been upset this month as well is the historical community, who were left shocked by Gavin Williamson's proposals over enforced free speech in universities, and in Oliver Dowden's comments that such measures were to defend our culture and history from the noisy minority of activists constantly trying to do Britain down. The National Union of Students says there is no evidence of a freedom of speech crisis on campus, and the Russell Group of leading universities says universities need to keep their institutional autonomy. The group warned against also creating unnecessary and burdensome bureaucracy. Why is the government taking these actions, Bim?
So, and I'm going to be very careful about this because I want to keep this genial. But anybody who's been to university, the idea of universities not liking bureaucracy is hilarious. And the idea that these universities say, oh, they need to be autonomous. Of course, universities are autonomous, but they are mostly funded by the government. And if they really want to be autonomous, then they should go private and run themselves and charge their own fees and do their own things. So, you know, frankly, I don't buy that. And as for the National Union of Students, I just feel sorry for anybody who's ever had the misfortune of ever having to spend time with any of these people, largely because student sort of activism, as we all know, is incredibly extreme and generally bonkers. Now, this does not mean that there isn't a serious point to engage with here. The serious point to engage with is there a problem with freedom of speech on campus? That is the core point. And I would contend that there is, and there has been, in many universities, in many instances, not all universities all the time, no. We're not America yet. So how do you deal with that? The way you deal with that is simply to enforce the rule by the government, and this is what governments are for, by saying you cannot exclude somebody who is not committing a crime, they are not inciting hatred, they are not inciting violence, simply because basically an extreme left-wing junta who in charge of, you know, a student society decides to want to no platform them. I mean, Amber Rudd, Conservative cabinet minister, was stopped speaking at Oxford for goodness sake. I couldn't believe it. You know, and Amber Rudd, for anybody who knows, you know, is hardly on the right of the Conservative Party, which makes the whole thing even more hilarious. And she was basically cancelled because a student society, you know, basically said they didn't believe she had the right to come and speak for whatever political reason they mentioned. So the difficulty with this is that most of this problem is not most students, it's not most academics. It's a minority of them who take over these student institutions, and they tend to sort of often be sort of incredibly bizarre and extreme politically. And they seek to ban anybody who they don't agree with. And I just think fundamentally that's wrong. And it is a disservice to the majority of students, the majority of academics, who are, broadly speaking, open-minded, and if they don't want to hear what someone has to say, then they won't go.
Would you not say, though, that somebody like Ayn Rand, with her huge protection of freedom of speech and the system of capitalism. She kind of summarized that there is no such thing as the right to an unrestricted freedom of speech on someone else's property. Does that not come into the ideology here? Because you can go into somebody's house, you can say what you want, but it is the right of the individual to then ask you to leave. Does that not come into the free speech argument as well?
Yeah, but we're not, it's not analogous, right? Because this isn't a majority of anybody at a university. They are mini junta that take over small student societies, of which there are about five people. And as a result, they are the people damaging the atmosphere for so many others. And it's just mad. And I just think that, frankly, a lot of it we've imported from the United States. I do find it hilarious about how much, you know, a lot of this stuff tends to come from the United States and comes over here. There's interestingly quite a historical point. I've been recently rereading Tom Holland's book, Dominion, where he talks about how this sort of, what some might term a sort of woke agenda sort of around certain issues is almost a modern equivalent of Puritanism that you found in the 16th, 17th century. And it's this sort of obsession with purity. And the only way to redeem yourself, at least partly redeem yourself, is to go in front of sort of courts of the pure and ritualize sort of cleansing and apology for your inherent sort of whiteness or evil or whatever it is. I do think a lot of this has come from the United States. This absolute way of thinking about the world has come from the United States. I think it's a regrettable thing. And in our universities in Britain, we need to preserve that multiplicity, that plurality of speech that makes this country great and makes university a pleasurable experience. Because ultimately, if you don't protect these things before they get going, it becomes impossible to deal with. And the universities, to be honest, I mean, look, I think my tone shows you what I think of what's happened at a lot of universities. The university leaderships, I'm not saying they're in favor of this stuff, but they need to clamp down on it. They need to be stronger in saying, no, we won't accept this in our university. And I think that that is mostly their failure. And the government is helping them to do that.
Just to extend this just a little bit more, Bim, because some people have pointed to the national curriculum almost being counter to freedom of speech. People have pointed to the fact that schools should not, under any circumstances, use resources produced by organisations that take extreme political stances on matters. So is this not freedom of speech going both ways? Because Michael Gove can invoke Gramsci at times, but then people can't be taught in a classroom about extreme political stances that maybe don't agree with what we are, you know, living at the moment. But to understand the opposing point of view, you still have to learn about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, and I've got some sympathy with it. However, what's really going on here is there are instances of certain teachers in certain schools, and I think it was quite a small number, frankly, who wanted to teach things like communism's great, and you know, I think you have to draw the line somewhere. The question people got to ask themselves is, if a teacher was teaching Nazism, you know, it was a great idea, it just wasn't quite delivered right. You know, if people were doing that, I think everybody would say, well, that's terrible. You know, so I just think you have to draw the line somewhere, and you have to have a broadly acceptable, dare I say it, sort of middle ground view of history, of culture, of science, of the country, because you, as a society, you need to build a shared knowledge and understanding, and it's the government's job to, on some level, make sure you establish those parameters. But that doesn't mean you're censoring everything. And look, I was at school where I learned everything from, in theology, from the New Testament, the Old Testament, to Black theology, which many of you know is very extreme theology, liberation theology, which comes out of the movement, the dictatorships in South and Central America, which is incredibly extreme theology, but I learned all of that. It's not preventing people from learning stuff, but it's about establishing the core fundamentals on which your basic national curriculum is based. And I think that's very sensible, because if the government doesn't do it, nobody else can.
Let's move the discussions on to what the local community wants to know, Bim. As always, with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community, and we called for questions for you, Bim. So let's move on to what people have asked you. The first one is from Marco, asking, why did Conservative MPs abstain from voting on cladding and then after offer help that has only been given to certain buildings that are over 18 metres tall? Why are residents being punished, he asks.
The answer is this has still got time to run and run. I think we are going to have to come up with something that works. The issue on the height was one of safety in terms of what the government's willing to pay for. Those that were those buildings that we felt were going to be dangerous. However, there's another issue, which is around the ability to sell, because if you can't sell, then you're stuck. And so I think, in fact, I know discussions with the banks, mortgage lenders, to say, what is it you need in order to be able to lend against certain property? And I think that once we work that out, we'll get there.
Sarah has asked about the 8,000 new laptops and tablets that you said will be available for disadvantaged students across Hertfordshire. She's asked, how can someone apply for one of these?
You can't, because it comes through the school. But if Sarah wants to get in touch with me, I'm very, very happy. If she feels that her or a member of her family or someone she knows needs a laptop, hasn't got it, get in touch with me.
Nicola has also sent in a message, and this is hot off the press. She sent it in today. She said, all over mainstream media and local Harpenden social media, I'm seeing ever increasing numbers of stolen dog notifications. Dogs are being stolen from residential gardens. What is BIM going to do to urge the government to bring in legislation and penalties for the perpetrators of this cruel activity?
The answer is that legislation doesn't solve most problems. Legislation is ultimately just a piece of paper. We have sufficient laws to stop this practice. The question is enforcing it. And it's really about getting the police to take it seriously. And it's about, and that is something I can do and will do. I know it's a problem. I have, frankly, my wife, who at the moment is trying to convince me to get a dog, constantly banging on to me about it, as are many friends. And I've heard it from friends in Harpenden as well, talking about it. So I know this is an issue. And I will definitely speak to the police and say, look, how are we enforcing this here? Because the truth is, it's more of an issue in some parts of the country than others. This issue isn't the law, the issue is enforcing the law. And it's really important that we don't think, how do we fix a problem, pass a law? Actually, how you fix a problem usually is get people to enforce the laws that are already there.
I always look forward to these moments in our discussions where we see politics in action there, because you're going to take on that discussion point there, and Nicola will hopefully be pleased by your response to that, and hopefully we do see a reduction in what is a terrible crime against innocent animals. Ian has moved the question on to a discussion point that was actually raised in last week's interview with Daisy Cooper. He expresses the fact that he was saddened to hear that some Conservative Party MPs have discussed or engage with groups that have linked to COVID conspiracies. Desmond Swain, Andrew Bridgen, and Adam Afury seem to be damaging the otherwise great work that has been done with the government over the vaccination scheme, he says. So will there be some sort of action taken against these individuals?
Well, look, I don't know about this, and it's very, very dangerous to comment on stuff you don't know about. What I do know is that it isn't wrong to engage with people who advocate a different course of action from one the government has taken. That is perfectly sensible. It's what politicians should do. And even if I disagree with it, or indeed if anybody else disagrees with it, because that's what politics is about. However, I don't want to comment on my other colleagues because, you know, that'll get me into trouble.
So Anthony has asked that maybe one day you might be in charge of your colleagues. He says, Bim, will you be vying to be Prime Minister one day? In short, he wants to know, what are your aspirations? Would you like to be a Cabinet Minister?
Well, this is a bit like when I met my girlfriend, my then girlfriend, now wife's father. And he said, you know, what are your intentions for my daughter? You know, this is a difficult question. What I will say is that I really want to work on economic issues, you know, and I hope the Prime Minister at some point appoints me to work on something like that. That's something I'm really interested in. But having said that, I'll probably now be sent to go and work on, I don't know, education or health or something. But yeah, that is what I want to do. I want to work on economic issues, make the country more productive and successful and prosperous. So that's sort of what I'm really interested in.
Okay, and the final question, I do try and end these interviews on a positive note, and Verulam sports fans will be interested to know as to whether you'll be going to any Arsenal matches by yourself or with your dad, who you've expressed is...
Yeah, with my dad. I'm going with my dad, and actually I'm going to take my boys. They're a bit small. So what I'm going to try and do is get to one of the Euro matches this summer, seeing as Boris has decided we're hosting them, which took everybody by surprise, I can say. But seeing as I think there's a very good chance we'll have a lot of football this summer, I am quite keen to go to those first. But yes, my dad's actually going to do his season ticket again next season. So I hope to take my boys because I think that these things, it's so important to do it when you're young, get into things. And that sounds a bit like sort of indoctrinating kids. Sounds slightly creepy, but what I mean by that is to give my boys a sense that football's a fun thing, and watching it live just brings it all alive when you then play it with your friends, etc. So yeah, I think that's what we'll do.
I can certainly attest to that. I mean, my love affair with Arsenal grew from going when I was very young with my dad as well. Just on that, do you have any superstitions that you do, or certain things that you have to do on a match day to make it a complete experience?
Gosh, that is such a good question. What I do with Arsenal is I always, always go for lunch somewhere on Upper Street near the game before. The Browns on Upper Street I particularly like. And I pretty much do that every game because I sort of don't like turning up at 5 to 3, going to the match, going home. That for me doesn't feel as... I sort of need to do it. I need to get into the game. I tend to read the papers, the sports papers, really properly that day, really get into it, think about the game, you know, listen to Talk Sport, really feel it and get in there. And I tend to do that over lunch. And quite often I'll do that. I'll go for lunch by myself because then I can sort of do that all on my own, which makes me sound deeply antisocial and weird. But but actually it's that getting into the atmosphere and the mood of it is very, very important indeed.
Well, that is a positive note to end on. And I think we can all agree that we're all looking forward to seeing sport and possibly football coming home with these Euro revelations. But as always, a thank you for your time today, Bim. And for those of you who didn't have their question answered, Bim will be returning next month. But for now, I just wish you wealth and happiness until we talk again.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Jason. Thank you.